Square. It was a fine summer's morning, cool and soft, with a promise of rain later in the day. Directly behind them was the Supreme Court, the highest court in the realm. To their right was Westminster Abbey and the medieval St. Margaret's Church. And directly before them, across the green lawn of the square, was the Palace of Westminster. The clock in the iconic bell tower read 5 minutes to 9 o'clock. Rush-hour traffic was flowing across Westminster Bridge and up and down Whitehall, past Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the Ministry of Defence, and the entrance to Downing Street, official residence of the Prime Minister. Yes, thought Gabriel again, what could possibly go wrong? He wore a radio earpiece in his right ear and a gun at the small of his back. The gun was a 9mm Glock 17, the standard-issue sidearm of SC-019, the tactical firearms unit of London's Metropolitan Police. The radio was connected to the Met's secure communications network. The head of SO-15, the counterterrorism command, was running the show with assistance from Amanda Wallace of MI5. Thus far, they had identified two potential suspects approaching Westminster. One was coming across the bridge from Lambeth. The other was making his way along Victoria Street. In fact, at that very instant, he was walking past New Scotland Yard. Both men were carrying backpacks, hardly unusual in London, and both were Middle Eastern or South Asian in appearance, also not unusual. The man coming across the bridge had started his journey in the borough of Tower Hamlets in East London. The one walking past New Scotland Yard had come from the Edgware Road section of North London. He was warmly dressed and looked to be suffering from the flu. "Sounds like our man," said Gabriel. "I'm betting on Edgware and influenza." "We'll know in a minute." Keller was leafing through that morning's edition of the Times. It was filled with news of Saladin's death. "Can't you at least—" "What?" "Never mind." The man from Tower Hamlets had reached the Westminster side of the bridge. He passed a Café Nero coffee house and the entrance to the Westminster tube stop. Then he passed an undercover CBRN team and two tactical firearms officers in plain clothes. No trace of radioactivity, no detonator in the hand, no sign of emotional distress. Wrong man. He crossed the street to Parliament Square and joined a small, sad protest having something to do with the war in Afghanistan. Was it still going on? Even Gabriel found it hard to imagine. He turned his head a few degrees to the right to watch the second man, the man from the Edgware Road section of North London, walking along Broad Sanctuary past the north tower of the Abbey. Keller was pretending to read the sporting news. How does he look? Sick as a dog. Something he ate? Or something he's wearing? He looks like he would glow in the dark. A CBRN team was on the north lawn of the Abbey, posing for photos like ordinary tourists, along with another SCO-19 unit. The CBRN team had already begun to detect elevated levels of radiation, but as the man from Edgware approached, the levels spiked dramatically. "Fucking Chernobyl," said Keller. "We've got him." A commotion erupted over the radio, several voices shouting at once. Gabriel forced himself to look away. "What are the odds?" he asked calmly. "Of what?" "That he chooses us." "I'd say they're getting better by the minute." The man crossed Broad Sanctuary to the Supreme Court building and entered Parliament Square at the southwest corner. A few seconds later, sweating, lips moving, pale as death, he was approaching the bench on which Gabriel and Keller sat. "Someone needs to put that poor bloke out of his misery," said Keller. "Not without an order from the Prime Minister." The man walked past the bench. "What level of exposure did we just suffer?" asked Keller. 10,000 x-rays. "How many have you had?"
11,000, said Gabriel.
Then he said quietly, "Look at the left hand." Keller did. It was clutching a detonator.
"Look at his thumb," said Gabriel.
"He's already putting pressure on the trigger."
"Do you know what that means?"
"Yeah," said Keller. "It means he's got a dirty bomb with a dead man's switch."
Big Ben was tolling 9 o'clock when the martyr-in-waiting reached the eastern flank of the square. He paused for a moment to watch the protest and, it seemed to Gabriel, to consider his options. The Palace of Westminster, which was directly before him, or Whitehall, which was to his left. The Prime Minister and his security aides were considering their options as well. At this point there was only one. someone had to grant the man the death he so badly wanted while someone else held his thumb tightly to the detonator switch. Otherwise, several people would die, and the seat of British power and history would be a radioactive wasteland for the foreseeable future. At last, the martyr-in-waiting turned to the left toward Whitehall, with Gabriel and Keller trailing a few steps behind. A gentle breeze blew from the north, directly into their faces. A breeze that would disperse the radioactivity all over Westminster and Victoria if the bomb detonated. The CBRN team that had been at Café Nero was now standing outside the Revenue and Customs building. Their readings were off the charts as the man walked past them. It was all the proof the Prime Minister needed. "Take him down," he said, and the head of the Counterterrorism Command repeated the order to Gabriel and Keller. Then he added quietly, "And may God be with you both." But on whose side, thought Gabriel, was God on that morning? On the side of the fanatic with a weapon of mass destruction strapped to his body? Or the two men who would try to prevent him from detonating it? The first move was Keller's to make. He had to seize the left hand of the martyr in an iron lock grip before Gabriel fired the kill shot. Otherwise, the martyr's thumb would weaken on the detonator switch, and the bomb would explode. They passed the archway of King Charles Street, and the entrance of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. The traffic along Whitehall dwindled. Evidently, the police had blocked it off at Parliament Square to the south and Trafalgar Square to the north. The martyr-in-waiting seemed not to notice. He was walking toward destiny, walking toward death. Gabriel drew the Glock pistol from the small of his back and quickened his pace, while Keller, a blur in his peripheral vision, drew a few deep breaths. Before them, the sweating, radiation-sickened martyr passed unseeing through a knot of tourists and started toward the security gate of Downing Street, his apparent target. He slowed to a stop, however, when he saw the black-uniformed police officers standing on the pavement. At once, he noticed the peculiar absence of cars in the normally busy street. Then, turning, he saw the two men walking toward him, one with a gun in his hand. The eyes widened, the arms rose, and stretched shoulder-width from each side. Keller rushed forward while Gabriel raised the Glock. He waited until the instant Keller grabbed the bomber's left hand before squeezing the trigger. The first two shots obliterated the bomber's face. The rest he fired after the man was on the pavement. He fired until his gun was empty. He fired as though he were trying to drive the man deep underground and all the way to the gates of hell. Suddenly there were police and bomb disposal technicians rushing toward them from all directions. A car pulled up in the street, the rear door opened, Gabriel hurled himself into the back seat and into the arms of Chiara. The last thing he saw as the car drove away was Christopher Keller holding a dead man's thumb to a detonator switch. Part 4. Gallery of Memories. Chapter 70. London. The evacuation of Westminster and Whitehall was far shorter in duration than Saladin might have hoped, but traumatic all the same. For 9 long days, the beating heart of British politics, the religious and political epicenter of a once glorious civilization and empire, was cordoned off from the rest of the realm and closed for business. The dead zone stretched from Trafalgar Square in the north to Millbank in the south and eastward into Victoria to New Scotland Yard. The great ministries sat empty, as did the Houses of Parliament and Westminster Abbey. Prime Minister Lancaster and his staff left 10 Downing Street and relocated to an undisclosed country house. The Queen, against her wishes, was moved to Balmoral Castle in Scotland. Only the CBRN teams were allowed to enter the restricted area, and only for limited periods. They moved about the deserted streets and squares in their lime-green hazmat suits, sniffing the air for any lingering traces of radioactivity, while the mournful tolling of Big Ben marked the passage of time. The reopening was a joyless affair. The Prime Minister and his wife Diana stole into Number 10 as though they were breaking into their own home. While up and down the length of Whitehall, civil servants and permanent secretaries returned quietly to their desks. In the House of Commons there was a moment of silence. In the Abbey, a prayer service. London's mayor claimed the city would emerge stronger as a result of the near disaster, though he offered no explanation as to why that was the case. A headline of a leading conservative tabloid read, "Welcome to the New Normal." It was a Wednesday, which meant the Prime Minister was obliged to rise before the Commons at noon and field questions from the political opposition. They were deferential at first, but not for long. Mainly they wanted to know how it was possible that just 6 months after the devastating attack in the West End, ISIS had managed to smuggle the makings of a dirty bomb into the United Kingdom. And how, given the elevated threat level, the security services had been unable to identify the bomber before the morning of the planned attack. The Prime Minister was tempted to say that the near-impossible security situation confronting Britain was the result of mistakes made by a generation of leaders, mistakes that had turned the land of Shakespeare, Locke, Hume, and Burke into the world's preeminent center of Salafist jihadi ideology. But he did not rise to the bait. "The enemy is determined," he declared, "but so are we."
"And the manner in which the suspect was neutralized?"
wondered the MP from the Washwood Heath section of Birmingham, a heavily Muslim city in the British West Midlands that had produced numerous terrorists and plots.
"It wasn't a suspect," interjected the Prime Minister. "It was a terrorist, armed with a bomb and several grams of radioactive cesium chloride."
"But was there really no other way to deal with him, other than a cold-blooded execution?"
the MP persisted.
"It was no such thing."
The stated position of Her Majesty's government and New Scotland Yard was that the two men who prevented the terrorist from detonating his dirty bomb were members of Met's SCO-19 Special Firearms Division. The Met refused to make public their names, nor did it agree to the media's request to release CCTV images of the operation. Somehow, there was only a single video of the incident shot by an American tourist who happened to be standing at the security gate of Downing Street at 9 o'clock. Out of focus and tremulous, it showed one man firing several rounds into the terrorist's head, while another man held the detonator switch in the terrorist's left hand. The shooter immediately left the scene in the back of a car. As it raced up Whitehall, he could be seen embracing a woman in the back seat. His face was not visible, only a patch of grey, like a smudge of ash, at his left temple. But it was his partner, the one who held the terrorist's thumb to the detonator for 3 hours, while technicians disarmed the dirty bomb, who received most of the media's attention. Overnight he became a national hero. He was the man who had selflessly risked his own life for Queen and country. But such stories rarely survive long, not in the graceless age of 24-hour news and social media, and soon there appeared numerous stories calling into question his identity and affiliation. The Independent claimed he was a former member of the Special Air Service, who had served notably in Northern Ireland and the First Iraq War. The Guardian, however, weighed in with a dubious claim that he was actually an officer of MI6. Lines had been blurred, the newspaper said, or perhaps even crossed. Graham Seymour took the unusual step of issuing a denial. "Officers of the Secret Intelligence Service," he said, "did not engage in law enforcement activities, and few ever bothered to carry a firearm." "The allegation," he declared, "is laughable on its face." Nearly lost in the finger-pointing was the fact that Saladin, the author of a transatlantic trail of bloodshed and broken buildings, was no more. At first, his legion of followers, including some who openly walked the streets of London, refused to believe he was really gone. Surely, they claimed, it was nothing more than a piece of black American propaganda designed to weaken ISIS's grip on a generation of young Islamic radicals. The photograph of Saladin's lifeless, retooled face didn't help matters, for it bore little resemblance to the original. But when ISIS confirmed his passing on one of its primary social media channels, even his most ardent supporters seemed to accept the fact he was truly gone. His closest lieutenants had no time to mourn. They were too busy dodging American bombs and missiles. London was the last straw. The final battle, the one ISIS hoped would lead to the return of the Mahdi and commence the countdown to the end of days, had begun. But what were the exact circumstances of Saladin's death at the compound in the Middle Atlas Mountains of Morocco? The White House and the President himself gave several conflicting versions of the story. Complicating the issue further was a report from an independent Moroccan news site concerning 3 Toyota Land Cruisers found in the southeast corner of the country, not far from the sand sea at Erg Chebbi. One of the SUVs appeared to have crashed, but the other two were burned-out shells. The website claimed they were destroyed by an American Predator drone, a claim supported by an accompanying photograph of Hellfire missile fragments. The White House denied the report in the strongest possible language. So, too, did the government of Morocco. Then, for good measure, it shut down the website that had published the photos and tossed its editor in jail. The allegation of an American drone strike on Moroccan soil ignited protests across the country, especially in the bidonvilles where the ISIS recruiters plied their deadly trade. The unrest nearly overshadowed the brutal killing of Mohamed Bakr, Morocco's largest producer of hashish, the self-proclaimed king of the Rif Mountains. The deplorable condition of the body, said the gendarme, suggested Bakr had been the target of a drug-related vendetta. Harder to explain was the fact that Jean-Luc Martel, the wildly successful French hotelier and restaurateur, had been found lying a few feet away with two neat bullet holes in the face. The Moroccans were not terribly interested in trying to determine how Martel had met his fate, or why. They wanted only to move the matter off their plate as quickly as possible. They delivered his body to the French embassy, signed the necessary paperwork, and bid JLM a fond adieu. In France, though, Jean-Luc Martel's violent end was an occasion for serious investigation, both by the press and the authorities, and no small amount of soul-searching. The circumstances surrounding his death suggested that the rumors about him had been true after all, that he was not a businessman with a golden touch, but an international drug trafficker in disguise. As details found their way onto the pages of Le Monde and Le Figaro, once promising political careers crumbled. The French president was forced to issue a statement of regret over his friendship with Martel, as were the interior minister and half the members of the National Assembly. As usual, the French press approached the matter philosophically. Jean-Luc Martel was viewed as a metaphor for all that was ailing modern France. His sins were France's sins. He was evidence that something, somewhere, was amiss with the Fifth Republic. Arrests soon followed, from the headquarters of JLM Enterprises in Geneva to the streets of Marseille. His hotels were padlocked, his restaurants and retail outlets shuttered, his properties and bank accounts seized and frozen. In fact, the only thing the French government didn't lay claim to was his corpse, which languished for several days in a Paris morgue before a distant family member from his village in Provence finally requested it for burial. The funeral and graveside services were poorly attended. Notably absent was Olivia Watson, the beautiful former fashion model who was Martel's companion and business partner. All efforts to locate Miss Watson, by the French authorities and the media, were without success. Her gallery in Saint-Tropez remained closed for business, its display window overlooking the Place de l'Homo empty of paintings. The same was true of her clothing boutique on the Rue Gambetta. The villa she shared with Martel appeared deserted. Curiously, so too did the garish palace on the opposite side of the bay. But was there a connection between the death of Jean-Luc Martel and the killing of the ISIS terror mastermind known as Saladin? A connection other than a similar time and place? Even the most conspiratorial-minded journalists thought it unlikely. Still, there were enough tenuous links to merit a second look, and look they did from the West End of London to the 7th arrondissement of Paris, to an empty art gallery in Saint-Tropez, to a patch of blood-soaked pavement near the entrance of Downing Street. Reporters who specialized in matters related to security and intelligence thought they could detect a pattern. There was smoke, they said, and where there was smoke, there was usually the Prince of Fire. In time, even the most carefully woven lies unravel. All it takes is a loose thread, or a man who feels compelled, for reasons of honor, or perhaps out of a sense of debt, to bring the truth to light. Not all of it, of course, for that would have been insecure. Only a small slice of it, enough to keep a promise. He gave the story to Samantha Cook of London's Telegraph, who crashed it in time for the Sunday edition. Within hours, it had set four distant capitals ablaze. The Americans ridiculed the account as pure fantasy, and the reviews from the British and the French were only slightly less caustic. Only the Israelis refused to comment. But then that was their standard procedure when it came to intelligence operations. They had learned the hard way that it was better to say nothing at all than issue a denial no one would believe anyway. In this case, at least, their reputation was well-deserved. The officer at the center of the story was spotted at the weekly meeting of the Prime Minister's fractious cabinet and, later that evening, with his wife and two young children at Focaccia Restaurant on Rabbi Akiva Street in Jerusalem. As for Olivia Watson, the former fashion model, gallerist, and not quite wife of the disgraced Jean-Luc Martel, her whereabouts remained a mystery. A prominent French crime reporter wondered whether she was dead. And though the reporter had no way of knowing it, Olivia was wondering the very same thing. Chapter 71 Wormwood Cottage, Dartmoor. They locked her away at Wormwood Cottage with only Miss Coventry, the housekeeper, for company, and a couple of bodyguards to watch over her. And old Parrish, the caretaker, of course, but Parrish kept his distance. He'd looked after all sorts during the many years he'd worked at the facility. Defectors, traitors, blown field agents, even the odd Israeli. But there was something about the new arrival that rubbed him the wrong way. As usual, for reasons of security, Vauxhall Cross had withheld the guest's name. Even so, Parrish knew exactly who she was. Hard not to. Her face was splashed across the pages of every newspaper in the country. Her body, too, but only in the racier tabloids. She was the pretty girl from Norfolk who'd gone to America to become a fashion model. The girl who'd been mixed up with the Formula One drivers and the rock stars and the actors and that horrible drug dealer from the south of France. She was the one the French police were supposedly searching for high and low. She was JLM's girl. She was a wreck the night she arrived, and remained one for a long time after. Her blonde hair hung long and limp, and in her blue Nordic eyes was a haunted look that told Parrish she had seen something she should not have. Thin as a rail already, she lost weight. Miss Coventry tried to cook for her, proper English fare, but she turned up her nose at it. Mainly, she sat in her room upstairs, smoking one cigarette after the next and staring out at the bleak moorland. First thing each morning, Miss Coventry placed a stack of newspapers outside her door. Invariably, when she collected the papers later in the day, several pages would be torn out. And on the day her face appeared in the sun beneath a deeply unflattering headline, the entire paper was ripped to ribbons. Only a photograph survived. It had been taken many years earlier, before the fall. Written across the forehead, in blood-red ink, were the words, JLM's girl.
"Serves her right to get mixed up with a drug dealer," said Parrish, judgmentally, "and a frog drug dealer at that."
She had no clothing to speak of, only the clothes on her elegant back, so Miss Coventry offered to make a run to M&S to pick up a few things to tide her over. It was not what she was used to, mind you. She had her own clothing line, after all. But it was better than nothing. Much better, as it turned out. In fact, everything Miss Coventry selected looked as though it had been designed and tailored to fit her long, slender frame.
"What I wouldn't give to have a body like that for just 5 minutes."
"But look at what it's got her," murmured Parrish.
"Yes, look."
By the end of the first week, the walls were beginning to close in on her. At Miss Coventry's suggestion, she went for a short walk across the moor, accompanied by a pair of bodyguards who looked far happier than normal. Afterward, she took a bit of sun in the garden. Once again, it was not what she was used to, the sun of Dartmoor being rather different than Saint-Tropez, but it did wonders for her appearance. That evening she ate most of the lovely chicken pie Miss Coventry placed before her, and then spent several hours in the sitting room watching the news on television. It was the night CNN broadcast the cell phone video shot by the American tourist outside Downing Street. When a grainy close-up appeared on the screen, a close-up of the officer who had held the terrorist's thumb to the detonator, she leapt suddenly to her feet.
"My God, that's him!"
"Who?" asked Miss Coventry.
"The man I met in France. He called himself Nicolas Carnot, but he's not a police officer. He's—"
"We do not speak of such things," said Miss Coventry, cutting her off, "even in this house."
The beautiful blue eyes moved from the television screen to Miss Coventry's face.
"You know him, too?" she asked. "The man in the video? Oh, heavens, no. How could I? I'm only the cook."
The next day she walked a little longer, and upon her return to Wormwood Cottage, she asked to speak to someone in authority about the status of her case. Promises were made, she insisted. Assurances had been given. She insinuated they had come directly from C himself, a claim Parrish found hard to believe. As if C would ever trouble himself with the likes of her. Miss Coventry, however, did not dismiss the idea out of hand. Like Parrish, she had witnessed many peculiar events at the cottage, such as the night a rather notorious Israeli intelligence officer was handed a copy of a newspaper that declared he was dead. An Israeli intelligence officer who, come to think of it, bore more than a passing resemblance to the man who'd fired several shots into the head of a terrorist on the pavements of Whitehall. No, thought Miss Coventry, it wasn't possible. But even Miss Coventry, who occupied the lowliest rung on the ladder of Western intelligence, knew that it was possible. And so she was not at all surprised to find on the front page of Sunday's edition of the Telegraph newspaper a lengthy exposé regarding the operation that had led to the killing of the ISIS terror mastermind known as Saladin. It seemed Jean-Luc Martel, the now deceased French drug trafficker and former companion of Wormwood Cottage's current occupant, was connected to the case after all. In fact, in the opinion of the Telegraph, he was the operation's unsung hero. Miss Coventry placed the newspaper outside the woman's bedroom door, along with her coffee. And later that morning, while straightening the room, she found the article intact and neatly clipped, resting on the bedside table. That evening, as a gale blew hard across Dartmoor, a man scaled the security gate without a sound and hiked up the gravel drive to the front door of the cottage. Entering, he wiped his feet and hung his sodden coat on the rack.
"What's for dinner?" he asked.
"Cottage pie," said Miss Coventry, smiling. "A nice cup of tea, Mr. Marlowe, or would you like something stronger?"
She served them dinner at the little table in the alcove and then pulled on her raincoat and knotted a scarf beneath her chin.
"You'll see to the dishes, won't you, Mr. Marlowe? And use soap this time, my love. It helps."
A moment later the front door closed with a gentle thump, and they were finally alone. Olivia smiled, for the first time in many days.
"Mr. Marlowe?" she asked, incredulously.
"I've grown rather fond of it."
"What's your first name?"
"Peter, apparently." "It's not the name you were born with?" He shook his head. "And Nicolas Carnot?" she asked. "He was just a part I played briefly to moderate acclaim."
"You played him well."
"Very well, actually."
"I take it you've met others like him?"
Jean-Luc seemed to attract them like flies. She studied Keller carefully.
"So how did you do it? How did you get the part so right?"
"It's the little touches that count," he shrugged. "Hair, wardrobe, that sort of thing."
"Or maybe it's a part you've played before," suggested Olivia.
"Maybe you simply reprised it." "Your dinner is getting cold," said Keller evenly.
"I never liked cottage pie. It reminds me of home," she said with a frown. "Of cold and rainy nights like this."
"They're not so bad." She took an exploratory bite of the food.
"Well," asked Keller, "it's not like eating in the south of France, but I suppose it will do."
"Maybe this will help." Keller poured her a glass of Bordeaux. She raised it to her lips.
"This is definitely a first."
"What's that?"
"Having dinner with the man who killed my—"
she faltered. Even she seemed at a loss over how to refer to Jean-Luc Martel.
"You fooled him at first, but once you told him you were British, it didn't take him long to figure out who you really were. He said you were a former SAS officer who had spent several years hiding out on Corsica. He said you were a professional—"
"That's quite enough," interrupted Keller. "I'm glad we cleared that up." After a silence, she said, "We're not so different, you and I."
"You're much more virtuous than I am."
She smiled.
"You never judged me?"
"Never."
And your Israeli friend?
People in glass houses.
I saw him in that video, said Olivia.
You too.
He was the one who killed the dirty bomber. And you were the one who held on to the detonator.
For 3 hours, she added softly. It must have been awful.
Keller said nothing.
No denials?
No.
Why not?
Why not indeed, he thought. He watched the rain hurling itself against the windows of the snug little alcove. Olivia drank some of the wine.
Did you have a chance to read the papers today?
Could you believe that story about Victoria Beckham in the mail?
How about the one in the Telegraph, about the killing of Saladin? The one about how Jean-Luc Martel helped British and Israeli intelligence penetrate Saladin's network and locate him in Morocco?
Interesting reading, said Keller, and true for a change.
Not all of it.
Reporters, said Keller dismissively.
I assume your Israeli friend was responsible.
He usually is.
Why did he do it? Why rehabilitate Jean-Luc's image after the way he acted at the camp in the Sahara?
Perhaps you didn't read the rest of the article, said Keller. The part about how Jean-Luc's beautiful British girlfriend didn't know how he really made his money. The part about how the French authorities have no interest in investigating her in light of Jean-Luc's role in eliminating the world's most dangerous terrorist.
I did read that part, she said.
Then surely you realize he didn't do it for Jean-Luc's sake. He did it for yours. You're clean now, Olivia.
Keller paused, then added, You're restored.
Just like you?
Much better, actually. You have your entire professional inventory of paintings, plus the 50 million we gave you for the Basquiat and the Guston. Not to mention the loose change we found lying under the couch cushions in the gallery. The building alone is worth at least 8 million.
Needless to say, said Keller, you're a very wealthy woman.
With a blackened name.
The Telegraph doesn't seem to think so. And neither will the rest of the London art world. Besides, they're nothing but a pack of thieves. You'll fit right in.
A gallery?
That was the promise my friend made to you that afternoon, at the villa in Ramatuelle, said Keller. A blank canvas upon which to paint any picture you want. A life without Jean-Luc Martel.
Without anyone, she said.
Something tells me you'll have no shortage of suitors.
Who would want to be with someone like me?
I'm JLM's...
Eat, said Keller, cutting her off.
She tried another bite of the pie.
How long will I have to stay here?
Until Her Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service determines that it's safe for you to leave. Even then it might be wise for you to retain the services of a professional security firm. They'll assign some nice ex-SAS lads to look after you, the kind Jean-Luc always hated.
Any chance you can serve on my detail?
I'm afraid I have other commitments.
So, I'll never see you again?
It's probably better if you don't. It will help you forget the things you saw that night in Morocco.
I don't want to forget. Not yet.
She pushed away her plate and lit a cigarette.
What's your name? She asked.
Marlowe. And then, almost as an afterthought, Keller added, Peter Marlowe. It sounds as though someone made it up.
Someone did.
Tell me your real name, Peter Marlowe. The name you were born with.
I'm not allowed to.
She reached across the table and placed her hand atop Keller's. Quietly she asked, And are you allowed to stay here so I won't have to be all alone on this cold and dreary English night?
Keller turned away from Olivia's blue eyes and watched the rain lashing against the windows.
No, he said. No such luck.
Chapter 72 King Street, London. She had no plans for a splashy opening, but somehow, with the help of a hidden hand, or perhaps by magic, plans materialized. Indeed, no sooner had the sun set on the second Saturday in November than the art world and all its unclaimed baggage came flowing through her door. There were dealers and collectors and curators and critics,
There were actors and directors from stage and screen, novelists, playwrights, poets, politicians, pop stars, a marquis who looked as though he'd just stepped off his yacht, and more models than anyone could count. Oliver Dimbleby pressed his gold-plated business card into the hand of any poor girl who happened to linger more than a second or two within his damp reach. Jeremy Crabb, London's last faithful husband, seemed incapable of speech. Only Julian Isherwood managed to mind his manners. He planted his flag at the end of the courtesy bar next to Amelia March of Art News. Amelia was gazing disapprovingly at Olivia Watson, who was posing for photographs in front of her Pollock, watched over by a couple of bodyguards.
"Worked out rather well for her in the end, don't you think?"
"How's that?" asked Isherwood.
"Gets herself involved with the biggest drug dealer in France, makes millions running a dirty gallery in Saint-Tropez, and now she's set up shop in St. James's, surrounded by you and Oliver and the rest of the old master fossils."
"And we are ever grateful she did,"
said Isherwood, as he watched a gazelle-like girl float past his shoulder.
"You don't find any of it odd?"
"Unlike you, Petal, I adore happy endings."
"I like mine with a grain of truth, and something about this doesn't add up. I'll have you know I intend to get to the bottom of it."
"Have another drink instead. Or better yet," said Isherwood, "have dinner with me."
"Oh, Julian." She pointed across a sea of heads toward a tall, pale man standing a few feet from Olivia. "There's your old client, Dmitri Antonov."
"Ah, yes.
Is that his wife?"
"Sophie," said Isherwood, nodding.
"Lovely woman."
"That's not what I hear. And who's the one next to her?" she asked.
"The dishy one who looks like another bodyguard."
"Name's Peter Marlowe."
"What's he do?"
"Couldn't say."
At 8:30, Olivia took up a microphone and made a few remarks. She was pleased to be a part of the great London art world. She was happy to be home again. She made no mention of Jean-Luc Martel, the unsung hero of the hunt for the ISIS terror mastermind known as Saladin, and none of the reporters present, Amelia March included, bothered to ask her about JLM either. She was free of him at last. It might as well have been stamped on her forehead. At the stroke of 9, the lights dimmed, and the music started up, and another wave of guests came squeezing through the door. Many were battle-scarred survivors of the blowouts at Villa Soleil, the ones who were busy being rich together, the ones with all the time in the world for everything. The Antonovs shook a few of the better hands before slipping into the back of their Maybach limousine, never to be seen again. Keller left a few minutes later, but not before pulling Olivia aside to offer his congratulations and bid her a good night. He thought she had never looked more beautiful.
"Do you like it?"
she asked, beaming.
"The gallery?"
"No,
the picture I painted on the blank canvas your friend gave me." She drew him close.
"I want to see you," she whispered into his ear. "Whatever happened in your previous life, I promise I can make it all better."
Outside, it was beginning to rain. Keller snared a taxi in Pall Mall and rode it to his maisonette in Queensgate Terrace. After paying off the driver, he stood on the pavement for a long moment and scrutinized the blinds in his many windows. His instincts told him there was danger present. Turning, he crept silently down the steps to the lower entrance and drew the Walter PPK from the small of his back before unlocking the door. He entered his own home in a whirling blur as he had entered the room in the southeast corner of the house in Zaida and leveled his gun at the man seated calmly at the kitchen counter.
"Bastard,"
he said, lowering the weapon.
"That one was close."
"You really have to stop doing this," dropping in unannounced.
"Breaking into my house. What would Mr. Marlowe's posh Kensington neighbors think if they heard gunfire?"
Keller tossed his crumbly overcoat on the marble-topped island, where Gabriel, illuminated by the restrained recessed lighting, sat atop a stool.
"You couldn't find anything to drink in my refrigerator?"
"Tea would be nice, thank you."
Keller frowned and filled the electric kettle with water.
"What brings you to town?"
"A meeting at Vauxhall Cross."
"Why wasn't I on the guest list?"
"Need to know."
"What was the topic?"
"What part of need to know
didn't you understand? Do you want tea or not?
The meeting concerned certain suspicious activities related to the Iranian nuclear program.
Imagine that. Hard to believe, I know.
And the nature of these activities?
The office is of the opinion that the Iranians are conducting weaponization research in North Korea.
SIS concurs.
It should, added Gabriel. We're sharing the same source.
Who is it?
Something tells me you'll know soon enough.
Keller opened one of the cabinets.
Darjeeling or Prince of Wales?
No Earl Grey.
Darjeeling it is.
Keller dropped a teabag into a mug and waited for the water to boil.
You missed quite a party tonight.
So I heard.
Couldn't fit it into your busy schedule?
Didn't think it would be wise to show my face in a part of London where it is rather well known. Besides, I went to great effort to make Olivia presentable again. I didn't want to spoil my work.
You removed the dirty varnish, said Keller.
Retouched the losses.
In a manner of speaking.
The article in the Telegraph was a lovely piece of work on your part. With one glaring exception, added Keller.
What's that?
The heroic portrayal of Jean-Luc Martel.
It was unavoidable.
Are you forgetting he put a gun to Olivia's head?
I saw the whole thing.
From the cheap seats.
Keller placed the mug of tea on the island. Gabriel left it untouched.
Obviously, he said after a moment, your feelings for Olivia are clouding your judgment.
I have no feelings for her.
Spare me, Mr. Marlowe. I happen to know that you were a frequent visitor to Wormwood Cottage during Olivia's stay there.
Did Graham tell you that?
Actually, it was Miss Coventry. Furthermore, Gabriel sailed on, it has come to my attention that you and Olivia shared an intimate moment tonight at the opening of her gallery.
It wasn't intimate.
Would you like to see the photograph?
Keller wordlessly poured two fingers of whiskey into a cut glass tumbler.
Gabriel blew on his tea.
Have I not been a good friend to you, despite the unfortunate circumstances of our beginning? Have I not offered you sound advice?
After all, if it wasn't for me, you'd still be—
Your point,
interrupted Keller.
Don't make the same mistake I made, said Gabriel.
Olivia knows more about you than any woman in the world other than that crazy fortune-teller on Corsica, and she's far too old for you.
What's more, Vauxhall Cross has already rifled through all her dirty laundry, which means SIS won't stand in the way of your relationship.
You were made for each other, Christopher. Grab onto her and never let go.
Her past is nothing compared to yours, said Gabriel. And look how well you turned out.
Keller held out his hand.
What? Asked Gabriel. Let me see it.
Gabriel handed his mobile phone across the countertop.
The happy couple, he said.
Keller looked at the photograph. It had been snapped from across the room while Olivia was whispering into his ear.
Whatever happened in your previous life, I promise I can make it all better.
Who took it?
Julian, said Gabriel, the true hero of the operation.
Don't forget the Antonovs, said Keller.
How could I?
They put in a brief appearance tonight, by the way. They actually looked happy for a change.
You don't say.
Think they're going to make it?
Yes, said Gabriel. I think they might.
Chapter 73 King Saul Boulevard, Tel Aviv. Which left one last loose thread. Not one, actually, but several hundred million, not to mention a haunted house in the heart of old Casablanca, a lavish villa by the sea on Francis Côte d'Azur, and a collection of paintings acquired under the expert eye of Julian Isherwood. The real estate was disposed of quietly and at a substantial loss, furnishings, caretakers, and gins included. The paintings, as promised, found their way to Jerusalem and onto the walls of the Israel Museum. The director wanted to call it the Dmitri and Sophie Antonov collection. Gabriel, however, insisted the donation remain anonymous.
But why?
Because Dmitri and Sophie don't really exist.
But the Antonovs' charity did not end there, for they had at their disposal a vast sum of money that had to go somewhere. Money they had borrowed, interest-free,
from the butcher of Damascus. Money the butcher had looted from his people before gassing and bombing them, and dispersing them to refugee camps in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. The Antonovs, through their representatives, donated countless millions to feed, clothe, house, and care for the medical needs of the displaced. They also pledged millions to build schools in the Palestinian territories, schools that did not teach children merely to hate, and to a facility in the Negev Desert that cared for severely disabled children, Jewish and Arab alike. Hadassah Medical Center received $20 million to help construct a new suite of underground operating rooms. Another $10 million went to the Bezalel Academy of Art and Design for new studio space and a scholarship program for promising Israeli artists from low-income families. The largest portion of the Antonovs' fortune, however, would reside at the Bank of Israel in an account controlled by the government agency headquartered in an anonymous office block on Kingsall Boulevard. The amount was sufficiently large to see to all of life's little extras. Assassinations, paid informants, defectors, false passports, safe houses, travel expenses, even an engagement party. Mikhail signed the last of the documents in Gabriel's office. In doing so, he laid Dmitri Antonov formally to rest.
"I'll miss him. He wasn't all bad, you know. For a Russian arms dealer," said Gabriel. "Did you bring the ring?"
Mikhail handed over the little velvet-covered box. Gabriel thumbed open the lid and frowned.
"What's wrong? Is there a stone in there somewhere?"
"A carat and a half,"
protested Mikhail. "It's not as nice as the one she was wearing in Saint-Tropez."
"That's true, but I don't have Dmitri's money."
"No," thought Gabriel, as he slipped the paperwork into his briefcase. "Not anymore." Kiara and the children were waiting downstairs in the parking garage, in the back of Gabriel's armored SUV. As they drove eastward across the Galilee, they were followed by a second SUV containing Uzi and Bela Navot, and a caravan of cars filled with more than 200 members of the officer's analytical and operational staff. It was dark by the time they all reached Tiberias, but Shamron's villa, perched atop its escarpment, overlooking the lake and the ancient battlefield of Hittin, was ablaze with light. Mikhail and Natalie were the last to arrive. The ring sparkled on Natalie's left hand. Her eyes sparkled, too.
"It's much nicer than Sophie's, don't you think?"
"Oh, yes," said Gabriel hastily. "Much."
"Did you have anything to do with this?"
"Only by offering you a job no woman in her right mind would ever have taken."
"And now I'm one of you," she said, holding up the ring. "Till death do us part."
The occasion lacked the debauchery of the Antonovs' notorious parties at Villa Soleil, and for that everyone in attendance was grateful. Truth be told, none of them were real drinkers. Unlike their allies, the British, they did not utilize heavy consumption of alcohol as part of their tradecraft. What's more, it was a school night, as they liked to say, and most would be back at their desks in the morning, save for Mikhail, who was leaving at dawn for an operation in Budapest. Office doctrine dictated he spend the night in a jump site in Tel Aviv. Gabriel and Yaakov Rossman, who was going with him, had granted Mikhail a reprieve. Still, there was music and laughter, and more food than anyone could possibly eat. Saladin, however, was not far from their thoughts. They spoke of him with respect, and even in death, with a trace of foreboding. Dina Sarid's dark prediction of the future, a future of endless cyber-jihad, was coming to pass before their eyes. The caliphate of ISIS was slipping away. Too slowly, it was true, but it was dying nonetheless. But that did not mean the end of ISIS was at hand. In all likelihood, it would become just another Salafist jihadi terrorist group, a first among equals with adherents around the globe, who were willing to take up a knife or a bomb or an automobile in hatred's name. Saladin was now their patron saint. And thanks to the story in the Telegraph, the story Gabriel had planted, Israel and the Jews of the diaspora were their primary targets.
"It was," intoned Shamron, "a grave mistake on your part."
"It wasn't my first," answered Gabriel, "and I'm certain it won't be my last."
"I hope she was worth it."
"Olivia Watson?"
"She was."
Shamron didn't appear convinced.
Perhaps you merely used her as an excuse to justify that reckless leak to that British reporter friend of yours.
Why would I have done something like that?
Maybe you wanted Saladin's followers to know that you were the one who killed him.
Maybe, said Shamron, you wanted to sign your name. They'd withdrawn from the party to Shamron's favorite spot on the terrace. The lake shone silver in the moonlight. The skies above the Golan Heights flashed yellow and white with American ordnance. They were hitting targets all over Syria. With his old Zippo lighter, Shamron ignited a cigarette.
Do they know what they're doing?
The Americans? Shamron nodded slowly. To be determined, said Gabriel.
That doesn't sound hopeful.
I've never cared for the word.
Optimistic, suggested Shamron.
There's little reason for it, said Gabriel. Let's assume the Americans and their allies eventually defeat ISIS and roll back the caliphate. What then? Will Syria be put back together again? Will Iraq? Will the Americans stay this time to ensure the peace?
Unlikely. Which means there's going to be several million disaffected and disenfranchised Sunni Muslims living between the Tigris and the Euphrates. They will be a source of regional instability for generations to come. They were artificial countries to begin with, Iraq and Syria. Maybe it's time to draw new lines in the sand.
Another failed Arab state in the making, said Gabriel. Just what the Middle East needs.
Perhaps now that Saladin is gone, they might actually stand a chance.
Shamron gave Gabriel a sidelong look.
I must say, my son, you took the concept of operational chiefdom rather too far.
You were the one who gave me that speech about walking and chewing gum at the same time.
That didn't mean I wanted you to rush headlong into a room and personally kill Saladin. What if he had been holding a gun instead of a cell phone?
The result would have been the same.
I hope so. There's that word again.
Shamron smiled.
I hope you saved some of that money.
The butcher of Damascus, said Gabriel, will be funding office covert operations for many years to come.
You gave an awful lot to help care for his victims.
It will pay dividends down the road.
Charity begins at home, said Shamron in disapproval.
Is that a Corsican proverb?
Actually, said Shamron, I'm fairly certain I coined it. 1/4 of the Syrian population is living outside Syria's borders, explained Gabriel, and most are Sunni Muslims. Helping to care for them is smart policy.
1/4, repeated Shamron,
and hundreds of thousands more are dead. And yet, we are the ones the world blames for the suffering of the Arabs. As if the creation of a Palestinian state would magically solve all the many problems of the Arab world. The lack of education and jobs, the brutal dictators, the repression of women. It's a party, Ari. Try to enjoy yourself. There isn't time. Not for me, at least.
Shamron slowly crushed out his cigarette.
This horrible war in Syria should make it abundantly clear what would happen if our enemies ever managed to breach our defenses. If the butcher of Damascus is willing to slaughter his own people, what would he do to ours? If ISIS is willing to kill other Muslims, what would they do if they could get their hands on the Jews?
He patted Gabriel's knee paternally.
But these are your problems now, my son. Not mine.
They watched the light show in the sky. The former chief, the current chief, while behind them their friends and colleagues and loved ones forgot for a few moments the world of trouble that surrounded them.
When I was a boy, said Shamron at last, I used to have dreams.
I had them too, said Gabriel. I still do. The wind blew softly from the west, from the ancient battlefield of Hittin.
Do you hear that? Asked Shamron.
Hear what?
The clashing of the swords. The screams of the dying.
No, Ari, I only hear the music. You're a lucky guy.
Yes, said Gabriel. I suppose I am.
Author's Note. House of Spies is a work of entertainment, and should be read as nothing more. The names, characters, places, and incidents portrayed in the story are the product of the author's imagination or have been used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, businesses, companies, events, or locales is entirely coincidental. There are many graceful old buildings in the Rue de Grenelle in Paris, entirely intact, but none house an elite counter-terrorism unit of the DGSI called the Alpha Group, for no such unit exists. Also, one will search in vain for the headquarters of the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service on King Saul Boulevard in Tel Aviv. It was moved long ago to a spot north of the city. The Liberty Crossing Intelligence Campus in McLean, Virginia, home of the National Counterterrorism Center and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, was destroyed in a terrorist attack in the Black Widow, but fortunately not in real life. Employees of the two agencies worked day and night to keep the American homeland safe. Gabriel Allon and his family do not reside at 60 Narcus Street in Jerusalem, but occasionally they can be spotted at Focaccia or Mona, two of their favorite neighborhood restaurants. There are several art galleries in the centre-ville of Saint-Tropez, some better than others, but none bear the name Olivia Watson. Nor will visitors to the St. James's section of London find an old master art gallery owned by anyone named Julian Isherwood, Oliver Dimbleby, or Roddy Hutchison. The paintings referenced in House of Spies were quite obviously used fictitiously. The author has no comment on the manner in which they were acquired, nor does he wish to imply that the murderous ruler of Syria maintains an account at the esteemed Bank of Panama. The title of Part 3 of House of Spies was suggested by a line from The Sheltering Sky, Paul Bowles' masterwork. The line also appears in the text of my novel, along with a portion of the subsequent sentence and one of Bowles' part titles. In addition, I borrowed iconography from Bowles and poetry from Sting, also an admirer of The Sheltering Sky, in my depiction of Natalie Mizrahi's brief moonlit foray into the sand dunes of the Sahara. Obviously, Gabriel plundered F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby and Tender is the Night when devising his operation, and it was more elegant as a result. Fans of the film version of Dr. No will doubtless recognize where Christopher Keller found his inspiration when describing the stopping power of a Walther PPK pistol. I completed the first draft of House of Spies, with its depiction of two ISIS terrorist attacks in London, one successful, one foiled, on March 15, 2017. At 2:40 p.m., on March 22, Khalid Massoud, a 52-year-old convert to Islam, turned onto Westminster Bridge in a rented Hyundai. While crossing the Thames River at speeds reaching 76 miles per hour, he mowed down several helpless pedestrians on the southern pavement and then crashed the car into a railing in Bridge Street outside the Houses of Parliament. There, he stabbed to death 48-year-old police constable Keith Palmer before being shot by an armed officer from the Metropolitan Police Service's Close Protection Command. In all, the attack lasted 82 seconds. Six people died, including Massoud, and more than 50 were wounded, some with catastrophic injuries. The threat level at the time was severe, meaning an attack was highly likely. 4 months earlier, however, Andrew Parker, Director General of MI5, was even more blunt in his assessment. "There will be terrorist attacks in Britain," he told the Guardian newspaper. "It is an enduring threat, and it's at least a generational challenge for us to deal with." ISIS's tactics differ from those of Al-Qaeda. A suicide vest, a gun, a knife, an automobile, a truck, these are the weapons of the new jihadist terrorist. But ISIS has loftier ambitions. The group's External Operations Division is feverishly attempting to build a bomb that can be smuggled onto a commercial airliner without detection. And there is ample evidence to suggest ISIS had been trying to acquire the ingredients for a radiological dispersion device, or dirty bomb. With the caliphate of ISIS under siege from the United States and its coalition partners, the flow of foreign fighters from the West and other Middle Eastern countries has slowed to a trickle.
Still, ISIS has proven adept at recruiting new members to its ranks. Oftentimes, they come with a criminal past. ISIS does not shun them. Quite the opposite. It is actively recruiting new members with criminal records, especially in Western Europe. Sometimes people with the worst pasts create the best futures. So read a social media posting issued by Rayat al-Tawheed, a group of ISIS fighters from London. The message was clear. ISIS is willing to employ criminals to fulfill its dream of building a worldwide Islamic caliphate. The nexus between crime and radical Islam is one of the most disturbing emerging trends confronting U.S. and Western European counterterrorism officials. Take, for example, the case of Abdelhamid Abaoud, the presumed operational mastermind of ISIS's attack on Paris in November 2015. Born in Belgium and raised in the Molenbeek section of Brussels, he served terms in at least three prisons for assault and other crimes before joining ISIS. Salah Abdeslam, Abaoud's accomplice and childhood friend, was also a petty criminal. In fact, they were once arrested together for breaking into a parking garage. Ibrahim El-Bakrawi, who detonated a suicide bomb inside Brussels airport in March 2016, fired on police with a Kalashnikov assault rifle during a 2010 attempted robbery of a currency exchange bureau. His younger brother, Khalid, who detonated a suicide device at a Brussels metro station, had a long criminal past that included convictions for several carjackings, a bank robbery, kidnapping, and weapons charges. Numerous ISIS operatives have come from the world of illicit drugs. ISIS has been linked to drug smuggling in the Eastern Mediterranean almost since its inception. But there is now evidence to suggest that the group, with its finances under strain, is involved in North Africa's lucrative hashish trade. Not long after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya in 2011, Western European police noticed a sharp increase in the flow of hashish from Morocco, along with a change in the traditional smuggling route, with Libyan ports serving as the primary point of departure. Had ISIS, which had established a presence in post-Gaddafi Libya, somehow attached itself to the hashish trade? European police couldn't say for certain, but they received a piece of welcome news in late 2016 when Moroccan authorities arrested Zeyan Berhili, allegedly one of the world's largest producers of hashish. Berhili was the owner of a large dessert company in Morocco, but according to Italian authorities, he made most of his money by smuggling an estimated 400 metric tons of hashish into Europe each year. The street value of those drugs would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 billion. Morocco exports more than just drugs to Europe. It also exports terrorists. Abdelhamid Abaoud, Salah Abdeslam, and Ibrahim and Khalid El-Bakrawi have more in common than a criminal past. All are of Moroccan ethnicity. More than 1,300 Moroccans have joined ISIS, along with several hundred ethnic Moroccans from Western Europe, mainly from France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. During a research trip to Morocco in the winter of 2017, I saw a country on high alert, and with good reason. The chief of Morocco's counterterrorism service warned in April 2016 that his unit had broken up 25 ISIS plots in Morocco in the last year alone, one involving mustard gas. Morocco's vital tourism industry, which draws thousands of Westerners to the country each year, is a primary target. Presumably, the United States and its partners will prevail in their campaign against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. But will the loss of the caliphate mean the end of ISIS-inspired or directed terrorism? The answer is likely to be no. Already, the physical caliphate is being replaced by a digital one where virtual plotters recruit and plan in the security and anonymity of cyberspace. But the blood will flow in the real world, in the rail stations, airports, cafes, and theaters of the West. The global jihadist movement has proven itself uncannily adaptable. The West must adapt too, and quickly. Otherwise, it will be left to ISIS and its inevitable offspring to determine the quality and security of our lives in the new normal. This is George Goodell. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of House of Spies by Daniel Silva. This program was produced by Kessler Media. The director was Robert Kessler.
Executive Producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2017 by Daniel Silva. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.